the matter of Donald Whiteman versus the Township Council of Berkeley Township and the Township of Berkeley. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Guckin, Dashkin, Guckin, Nichols, Connors, Anthony, Buckley, and Jeff Porky. Passing on Joseph Nicolini from non-terminating meeting on behalf of Donald Whiteman, which is all that.
Welcome, welcome, counsel. Mr. McGuckin.
If I may, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine. And please keep your voice up.
Sure. Good afternoon, members of Supreme Court. Thank you for accepting the petition of Berkeley Township in this matter. We respectfully submit that in this case, one of the reasons we're here is because the trial court, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, appeared before a dozen times. But the trial court clearly failed to review the entire record before the planning board with respect to this de-annexation petition. The trial court made serious errors of fact and an error of law. The first was in page 17 of the trial court's decision. The trial court said de-annexation in this case will have no impact on school taxes. It's one of the critical findings in this case. The record before the planning board and before the township's governing body and during the trial, substantial testimony was presented. Expert reports were provided evidencing that even the petitioners, I refer to them petitioners and plaintiffs, even though I may be the petitioner here, the plaintiff's own expert testified before the board and submitted an expert report that there would be a minimum $121 school tax increase for the remaining residents of Berkeley Township. That was their testimony. It was in the record. It was argued at the time of trial, yet the trial court decided that there would be no impact on school taxes. Most of the argument related to the municipal tax rate. The second error the trial court made of finding a fact, and again, is included within her decision, is after excoriating the township's consulting planner and his involvement, Mr. Weiser, in this proceeding, the court said, and by the way, he wasn't even called to testify before the board. As a result, in the court's opinion, he was never subject to cross-examination on any discussions he had with any witnesses, on any opinions he may have with respect to his report. That is demonstrably incorrect. And the transcript of his testimony was before the court. The arguments about his testimony was before the court. His report itself was before the court. And for the life of me, I can't understand how the trial court made those factual errors. The third error the trial court made was that she applied an improper standard for 2.5 pages in her decision. And that standard was that, don't worry, Berkeley Township, in the future, you have some vacant land in the mainland. And as a result, you will be able to achieve additional ratables in the future, which will offset any tax increase that would otherwise occur as a result of de-annexation. That is an incorrect statement of law. In the appellate division agreed that was an incorrect statement of law, agreed that that was not a proper basis for the court to make her decision, but chose not to reverse on that ground. The trial court also admitted, the appellate division also noted that the trial court was wrong with respect to Mr. Weiser and whether he ever testified in the matter, whether he was subject to cross-examination, whether he was questioned about any meetings and testimony, et cetera. Well, there is that that's not enough either to reverse the trial court. And with respect to school taxes, the appellate division ignored it. They didn't address it one time, not once. The record in this case clearly establishes that there will be a $121 increase on the residents, remaining residents of Berkeley Township as a result of the school tax increase that will result from the loss of 10.63% of the township's tax base. That cannot be ameliorated by anything to do with the township. There's nobody they can lay off. It is not part of their budget. They don't have any control over the school district. They can't lay off police officers to ameliorate that fact. They can only address the municipal tax rate. There's lots of colloquy about how big a tax increase there would be from the municipal tax rate. For purposes of this argument, I think it's important to focus on the fact that the school tax increase is the one that has not been adequately addressed by the courts below. Now, it's important to also recognize, and when we talk about the school tax increase, we're talking about 2014 numbers. So when we say, well, it's $121, that doesn't sound like a lot. Well, this is 11 years ago. You can imagine this court can certainly take judicial notice of property taxes have not gone down over the last 11 years. So that impact remains for the remaining residents of Berkeley Township. Trial court misunderstood, apparently, that there are two school districts that affect Berkeley Township. One is the Central Regional District, which is the middle and high school district. That is a constituent made up of a number of towns, including Berkeley Township. But the Berkeley Township School District only is addressed by Berkeley Township and is only taxed with respect to Berkeley Township. And losing 10.68% of their tax base to fund that school is the, we submit, substantial detriment that the township is facing as a result of this decision. Now, the statute was amended, as we know, in 1982. That statute has not been frequently litigated, but it has been more recently. And that statute amendment was designed to encourage the preservation of boundaries of municipality, the historical nature of boundaries. This part of Berkeley Township has been part of the community since it was created 150 years ago. We believe that is an important factor for the court to consider and that the board considered hearing this case. Respectfully, despite these facts that were done incorrectly at the trial court and not addressed by the appellate division, we believe a substantial portion of this case has focused on a red herring issue. And that is the due process argument, the bias and so forth and prejudice that the board evidenced with respect to the petitioners in this case. Now, statute is silent as to what the procedure is supposed to be. Statute doesn't say anything other than the board is supposed to submit a report within 45 days. What did Berkeley Township do here? We had 38 separate hearings. We have permitted the plaintiff to present over 40 witnesses. We permitted the plaintiff to present expert testimony from planners and financial experts to show if they could meet their burden of proof in this case. The township never prohibited the petitioners from presenting any evidence on the financial impact to the remainder of Berkeley Township, not once. I would submit on behalf of the township that had the township really been biased, really been prejudiced, and really committed a due process violation, they wouldn't have allowed any of that testimony. They would have said, no, we don't need to hear your experts. We don't need to hear you try to explain the financial impact. We've made a decision and we're just going to do it. The purpose of the hearing is to allow the petitioners to create a record. So the court can determine if the decision of the governing body ultimately made is arbitrary or capricious. In this case, the petitioners had more than an adequate opportunity to create that record. And their own testimony reveals that the third prong of the test under the statute is there a substantial detriment to the remainder of Berkeley Township. The testimony is uncontroverted. It's stipulated. It was agreed that there would be a school tax increase of $121. Now,
could I go back, of course, for a second to your due process argument? And this is it. I was struck by an argument that you made that the legislature, had it intended for completely neutral bodies to decide this, would have sent these petitions to the courts and not to the towns themselves and not the planning board. Does that same argument extend to all of the work that the planning board does?
It does extend to some. For instance,
don't we expect that planning boards will act as professional bodies making decisions in light of the applications that come before them and not political reasons?
Well, I think that this is not an application per se under the municipal land use law. This is a statutory proceeding on de-annexation, no different than a statutory proceeding on the planning board's review of a zoning ordinance or the planning board's review of a master plan.
But it strikes me that you're endorsing the notion that the legislature wanted these hearings to go before political partisan bodies.
And I believe that's true. I believe that's exactly what the legislature intended, that it goes before the partisan political body. I wouldn't say partisan. I would say political public body, policy bodies. And that's why I went to the planning board and not a zoning board.
It's the political that I'm struggling to accept your argument.
There are those who say that's a dirty word. I would indicate that the legislature certainly knew that a planning board is made up of a mayor, class one member, member of the governing body, class three member, and an official of the municipality, class two member. That planning board is designed under the law to serve the public policy interests of the elected officials while simultaneously providing due process that is required. And we don't, and first of all, we don't submit that there were due process violations by in any stretch of the imagination. No way. We do agree that the plaintiff was given the opportunity to present their case. And that record revealed that there would be a substantial detriment. Now, in this case,
do you think your argument needs to go as far as the language that you've used in your brief?
Well, apparently not.
Counselor, can I just follow up on the chief's question? Are you saying that even an appearance of bias at that stage would be acceptable?
Well, I guess I think it's important to discuss what is the appearance of the bias that was raised. We vigorously dispute that there was bias.
So you say you vigorously dispute, but at one of the hearings, Mr. Weiser, he acknowledged, right? He admitted that there was a potential appearance of bias of his having participated in strategy sessions.
The problem with that is, how does the board hear a case for deannexation? Had the township hired their attorney or retained an attorney or used the township attorney to present the township side of the case or the issues that were not addressed by the petitioners, but which were important to the board to make the decision, would that be bias?
Well, according to Mr. Weiser, I think it might be.
Well, there's a difference between appearance and actual bias. And the reason I say that is because the record was created. And if the planning board members had some personal opinion on the matter before it started or during the hearings, are they supposed to set those aside completely? Are they supposed to not figure out what's in the best interest of the municipality? I don't submit that's bias. I believe that's what a planning board is supposed to do.
But here, what we're talking about is participating in strategy sessions. I think the other question was about helping to identify material items to refute. And that's what Mr. Weiser said. Yeah, that could present an appearance of bias.
Well, I understand it could present an appearance. But the fact is, who else is going to do that in a de-annexation case? Somebody has to do it. Somebody has to contact the director of public works to say, by the way, the petitioners claim this. Can you testify about that? Someone has to contact the police chief to say, they say there was an inadequate response time on this date and time. Can you provide information with respect to that?
Sorry, can you say that one more time? So are you arguing that the planning board itself represents the municipality? And because this is a de-annexation petition from the municipality, there's no difference if the planning board were to come up with the evidence in favor of the municipality or if the municipality were to hire an attorney to come up with the evidence in favor of the municipality?
I think there's no difference from a bias and argument of a petitioner that whichever way you do it, obviously you're taking a position contrary to what we're presenting to you. So if the board hires somebody or the township hires somebody, either the board or township is taking an adversarial position with respect to the petitioners.
And your point is that the board consists of the leaders of the township. Can you explain one more time who you were explaining the legislature would know that the board would have to consist of?
So the statutory membership of a local planning board includes the township's mayor or his designee. That's a class one. It includes a township official, usually an employee of the municipality who answers to the mayor. And it includes a member of the governing body, the class three member, selected by them. The rest of the members are appointed directly by the mayor. That's the membership of a planning board. And planning boards are designed to effectuate the policy of those elected officials respectfully. Now, so that doesn't mean in every case that they're supposed to do whatever they want. Of course not. Sometimes planning boards act in a quasi-judicial capacity. They have variances that accompany subdivision applications. They have variances that accompany site plans. Of course, they serve in a quasi-judicial capacity in those positions and in those applications.
And we want them to make apolitical decisions in that regard, don't we?
That's correct. That's correct.
But your argument is that the legislature, knowing the makeup of planning boards, there's an expectation that the members of the planning boards would act in what they think is the best interest of the municipality, even if that does appear to be, I'm trying to understand.
I understand that's the petitioner's argument, but that and the court's question is appropriate, but the planning board is the entity that the legislature decided should hear. Legislature certainly knew who sits on a planning board, how they're appointed, how they have to act on the master plan, what is in the best interest of the municipality, short term, long term. And I believe that's why the legislature wanted it to go to a planning board.
The planning board is statutorily charged with acting in the best interest of the municipality?
Well, I think their duty under oath is to serve the best, to serve the Constitution and the state laws of the state of New Jersey. That's obviously what they're required to do. And I believe they did that here.
An MLUL application, they have to apply this statute objectively, even if correct. That may not be the preference of
and the legion of case law on how they're supposed to act in those cases. That's not the case in a de-annexation petition, respectfully. We believe this is more of a legislative and administrative function of a planning board, just like a master plan would be.
But during the hearing process, right, should that have been a time that the planning board has predetermined what their position is and taken actions that could give an appearance of bias?
Well, I think it's important to recognize two things. Number one, I don't believe there was a predetermination, and I don't believe there was bias. When a planning board asks questions of an applicant, when there's no other attorney on the other side, only the petitioner's attorney is present. And when the planning board asks questions, quite frankly, it's no different than this court asking me a question. I certainly don't believe you're biased or prejudging any matter. But when the planning board asks questions of the petitioners in this case, who else is supposed to do that? How is the board supposed to make their determination? Is that bias? Is that prejudice? Of course not.
Is there any dispute as to Mr. Weiser's participation in the process?
Well, I think the dispute relates to how it was characterized in some of the by the trial court. And that is, Mr. Weiser was hired to assist the board in getting the evidence necessary for the board to make a determination.
Does that include preparing witnesses to testify?
I don't think he prepared any witnesses for testimony. I think what Mr. Weiser did, and was cross-examined on repeatedly, by the way, Mr. Weiser provided the transcripts of what the petitioner said about the director of public, about the Department of Public Works. And he gave that to the director of public works and said, you should be prepared to address these issues. And by the way, every witness that was called before the board, every township witness who met with or discussed or received something from Mr. Weiser was cross-examined by the petitioners. They were asked on the record repeatedly, did Mr. Weiser tell you what to do? Did he coach you in what answers to provide? The answer to that is no. There's no smoking gun in any of that. That's not true. But who else would do it? If I, as the board attorney, did it, that would be a claim of bias and prejudice. If the township attorney did it, the township is the one who makes the ultimate decision. That would be bias or prejudice. So who else would do it?
So someone you're saying that there is no way for the township to be able to show how a de-annexation would harm them under the statute, because there's no, the township can't hire an attorney, the township can't present its case to the planning board. There's just no way for them to present evidence of how they would be harmed?
Well, I think the problem is there's no answer to that question as of yet. And I think the best answer I can provide to the court is that the statute doesn't say any such thing. And if the township did that, then the argument would be that from the beginning, the township was opposed to our application because they went and hired experts to oppose us. They went and hired lawyers to cross-examine us. They went and hired a planner to rebut testimony that we present. Respectfully, I believe the petitioners would prefer just to allow their testimony, their experts. Nobody questioned them. The township can have no role. The township, and there's no provision in the statute for them to do so. So what's happened over the limited number of hearings that have been held with respect to cases such as this, usually the township has relied upon a planner to do it. And that's one of the reasons Mr. Weiser was selected, because he's done it before in another town. I believe CB Harbor.
I'm sorry, I couldn't. In what?
I believe he was involved in the CB Harbor case.
CB Harbor.
Can you address the statement about collusion between the board and the planning board?
Between the, I'm sorry, the board and?
The township board and the planning board.
I am not aware of any testimony or comments from anybody who testified that there was some collusion between the township's council, mayor, and the planning board. Not aware of any such evidence. At the beginning of the case, the township called the board's professionals and said, hey, what's this about? We've never had one of these, or we haven't had one for decades. How do we handle this? And of course there was a meeting. This is the procedure that needs to be followed. The board hears it, they have to make a decision, they have to make a recommendation, and then the governing body will make a decision at the conclusion of that.
But some of the planning board members, I thought you said, were also employees of the township. So it kind of like saying there is some sort of official distinction between the two seems not to be reality based on who is required to be on the planning.
And I think that's contemplated by the legislature when it created and sent it to the planning board, that the township officials who serve on a planning board have are supposed to be looking, as are all the board members, at what is in the best interest of the municipality.
Except the planning board is a part of the township.
I'm sorry?
The planning board is a something of the township.
Yes, that's correct. But I don't recall any testimony other than meetings between professionals and certain staff of the township as to the procedure to be followed, how to notify department heads who to go to, when to be there. We certainly don't want the police chief sitting through 27 meetings of the board when it didn't affect the police department. And from the beginning, we documented the hearings as two particular issues so that that would be the case. And those witnesses were provided those transcripts and said, here's what's out there. Here's what they're claiming. Be prepared to address this before the board. If it's true, then say, yes, it's true. If it's not true, then say so and say why. I don't see how that is bias or prejudice or any such thing in a proceeding such as this.
Could you go back to the school tax for a moment and give us just a little bit more about the reason for the increase? You mentioned the loss of ratables. How does that factor in?
So, as I said, there are two schools that affect Berkeley Township. Berkeley Township is part of the Central Regional School District. So is Seaside Park. So the loss of South Seaside Park to Seaside Park would mean that tax base would be transferred to Seaside Park, and that tax bill for their Central Regional School District would simply be shifted from that part of Berkeley Township to Central Regional. That would not make a financial difference to the residents of Berkeley Township remaining. And again, this was stipulated at the hearings. Their own expert, petitioner's own expert said so. But the problem is the Berkeley Township School Districts, which educates K to 6, is made up only of Berkeley Township residents. Their tax base is only Berkeley Township. Part of that included, for all these 150 years, South Seaside Park, which includes 10.6% of our rate base. So by taking away that 10.6% rate base, every other resident of Berkeley Township now has to make up that difference in their tax bill for purposes of operating Berkeley Township schools.
Is it as simple, theoretically, as there were two lines? One was for the municipal tax, one was for the school tax, and the top and that second line got lost in the analysis?
I think that's true. I do. And I think the trial court saying there's no impact, I think because she only looked at the central regional portion of it, not the municipal portion of it, the local school district.
Is the number of school students in the elementary school, would that be decreased by virtue of the annexation?
So the interesting fact in this case is that the testimony is any annual year, there's only one or two students that come from South Seaside Park to the Berkeley Township School District. Maybe some years it's four, maybe some years it's one, but extremely limited number of students come from that. So the fact that South Seaside Park is leaving or could leave has no impact on the Berkeley Township School District. They still have to raise the same amount of revenue. They're not laying off anybody. They're not firing anybody. They still have to run the schools with what they have left. And that means every other resident of Berkeley Township would have to subsidize this de-annexation.
So you have a handful of students from South Seaside. How many from the other parts of the township?
In the Berkeley Township School District, 100%, other than the handful that may not, who may be in Seaside Park.
How many students actually?
Oh, in the school district.
For the
I believe it was 1,400 in the Berkeley Township School District.
And only four or five in any given year from Seaside, South Seaside?
I'd say one to four, quite frankly, but yes.
Four.
That's correct. That's not going to make an impact. They're not getting rid of a teacher. They're not getting rid of a building. None of that would apply. And that's why petitioner's own experts said that $121 increase is going to happen.
So what's the overall increase in taxes if you add in the school tax?
Well, we submit that the overall increase is $185 under 2014 numbers. Petitioners claim it's the municipal tax increase is completely offset by getting rid of police officers or police cars, et cetera. The municipal tax rate is, you know, much less than the school district tax rate. So the trial court and the appellate division seem to conclude that if you take away a police officer or two, or get rid of a police car or two, you would offset the increase in the municipal tax rate. But nowhere do they address the increase in the school tax rate. And that's the biggest portion of any tax bill. And again,
and your point is that even getting rid of two police cars would have nothing to do with a school tax because the police cars are not used for anything related to the school district.
We have absolutely no ability to offset the tax increase for the school district. And the school district, I believe in the record, there's a letter from the school district saying we don't intend to make any changes by the result of losing one or two students from South Seaside Park.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I think I have to address the due process issues. And I think the way I'd like to address it is that I would agree there would be a due process violation in a de-annexation petition if a board was so biased and so prejudiced that they somehow prohibited the petitioners from presenting the facts they need to present to meet their burden of proof. They have to establish first that it would be beneficial to the residents who wish to leave, and they have to prove that there would not be a substantial detriment to remaining residents. That's what they had to prove. If the board was so biased or prejudiced that they prevented a litigant from providing that information to put in the record, I would say that that would be a due process violation. But I don't believe questioning a witness or voicing an opinion, one, a member of the governing body, voicing an opinion before the hearing, saying, hope you pay attention to this residence because your taxes may go up. That's a factually true statement. It's undisputed. And it's absolutely appropriate for an elected official to tell the residents of their community that that would happen. But the court finds that somehow it's bias and prejudice.
In any of these other cases, has the board similarly never been able to put on any kind, even though there's overlap, has the township not been able to put on any evidence? It's just the board only listens to petitioner's evidence and there is nothing from the other side ever?
So in West Point Island, a decision of this court from 1972, I believe, the township took the position that we don't have to put anything on. We don't have to prove anything. And the court really can't interfere with our decision not to let them go. And of course, the Supreme Court said, no, that's not the way it works. You as a township, if you think there's something you need to do, you could present. Now,
but at the time, the township bore the burden under the statute, and then the legislature amended the statute so that now the petitioner bears the burden.
That's absolutely correct. And I would also point out in that case, the mayor of the township testified and said, no, there won't be, we'll be able to make this up. There's really no tax impact to us in 1972. In Tom DeRue Township, Dover Township at the time. So in that case, that's the only case I've found that says that. Everything since the statute has clearly indicated the school tax is a critical element to determine if there's been a substantial detriment to the remaining residents of the township.
But sorry, I had a different question. In every case since the amendment, has the township not been able to do anything to put on evidence? It's just only the petitioner's evidence and anything from the township would be considered bias on the part of the township, which makes the final decision after the planning board, or the planning board, which makes the initial decision?
Very interesting. Both in Avalon and Seaview Harbor, two most recent decisions on this case, and the two reported appellate division decisions, the township did present evidence through a planner. And in fact, in Seaview Harbor, it was the same exact planner, Mr. Weiser, who presented testimony, gave an opinion, gave a report, but also coordinated the submission of witnesses to the planning board. That's what happened in CPR.
On behalf of the township.
That's correct. Well, on behalf of the board and the township, because there's no adversary.
They're kind of the same anyway.
They are. But there's no adversary in these proceedings. And if there is an adversary, the argument is you're biased and prejudiced and you can't make a proper decision. So that's really the crux of this. If you have a quasi-judicial proceeding, there should be an adversarial process. We don't advocate
Seaview
that.
Harbor, though, didn't the allegation, the allegedly biased members recuse themselves?
There was one member who recused himself and not recused himself, chose not to vote on the decision because he was a resident of South Seaside Park.
No, in Seaview Harbor.
Oh, in Seaview Harbor?
There was alleged bias against some of the members and they recused themselves.
Yeah, I believe that was the case. And I believe that bias was pretty evident from my recall from the facts of that case. I don't believe that's anything close to what we have here. Simply because board members ask questions. I don't see how that's bias or prejudice or, you know, courts are also in the same position. I just don't see it. In this case, one member of the governing body made one comment, factually correct, as he should to the residents, that your taxes are going to go up. Everybody knew the taxes were going to go up. Petitioners knew it. The board knew it. The governing body knew it. And the court knew it when it came before the court because the court noted it in her opinion.
Counsel, one other question. Isn't it a mathematical certainty on deannexation if individuals or if citizens are lost that the remaining citizens would have to bear or carry a greater burden for the school tax base? Isn't that a mathematical certainty?
Usually that's the case. However, it depends on the facts of the case. And by that, I say Bay Beach Way versus Toms River Township is the only case where the courts have allowed a petition for deannexation to be permitted. That was one street in a town of 80,000 people. And the increase in taxes was 0.0038%. 1/8 of 1%.
Well,
of 1 cent of the tax rate.
West Point Island went forward.
No, I'm talking about Bay Beach Way.
I'm saying West Point Island also, deannexation was ordered. right?
Yeah, before that was in the prior statute.
But there's still going to be an impact. To a mathematical certainty, there will always be an impact.
Correct, and that's why the statute says, that can the plaintiffs establish that there will not be a substantial burden on the remaining residents?
I thought you said the mayor in the West Point Township case said there wouldn't actually be any impact.
That was in the West Point case, that's correct. The mayor said, testified that there wouldn't be any tax impact on Dover Township. That's correct.
The geography here is really quite striking. And I obviously won't take the time to talk about what's in the record, but it is a population and a location that is relatively far from the township. It appears that the trial court took that into consideration in a major way. Do you see the statute as focused on geography?
It's not. And the cases that have come before the courts have all been Barrier Island communities seeking to de-annex from mainland areas because they share probably an unfair tax burden in many respects. Their properties are worth more, they pay more, and then the services are not as provided. For instance, South Seaside Park pays 10.6% of the school tax, but they only have two or three residents who attend the school. That's been the case for 150 years. That's not different. And in this case, had the legislature intended for that to be a factor, certainly would have been included.
It's part of the case law, CBU Harper.
It's part of this case law with respect to the burden of the petitioner to show that it's for their benefit, that it benefits them socially and economically. That's the first prong of the statute.
But doesn't CBU Harper talk about geographic location, physical connection to the town or lack thereof as a consideration in this analysis?
It's absolutely consideration for the second prong of the test, and that is whether it would be socially advantageous to the people wishing to leave to be part of an adjoining municipality on the Barrier Island or elsewhere. Absolutely, that's an important factor for that part of the statute, but it has no bearing on the issue of substantial prejudice to the rest of the municipalities. If so, the legislature would have included that as a requirement.
Are you conceding the second factor?
I'm not conceding it. It would take me an hour to go through each and every one of the arguments to try to convince this court otherwise. I'd be glad to do that if you would like. We've submitted it in our appellate brief. We don't believe that those allegations are of merit. But realistically, in this case, the substantial detriment to the remaining residents is where the plaintiffs have failed.
But would you agree that as to the second factor alone, there's a pretty compelling argument about geography and about the social distancing that exists?
I agree. And I think, unfortunately, the trial court sort of balanced those in her decision, which is not what the statute requires. It's not a balancing test.
It's a four-prong analysis where they have to prove everyone, right?
Yes. And prove each of those three. And clearly, it's debatable on the second one. I certainly understand that. It's really not debatable on the third. And that's their burden.
Anything at this point, we'll have you back for rebuttal.
I'll be back when you need me. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Michelini.
May it please the court. This case is extraordinary, not just because of the distances that are involved, over 16 miles between the quarter square mile that's on the peninsula and the mainland, but it's extraordinary, I think, really in terms of the due process violations. And I'd like to go into those a little bit because I think they're really important here. We had 38 hearings over a period of actually 5 years. They started in January of 2015. The last hearing at which testimony was given was November of 2019. So it was really a full 5 years. During that time, 13 hearings got canceled by the township, or the planning board, I should say, for whatever reason. I'm not going to get into that. But after the hearings in 2019, there was a 9-month delay. First, at the front end, there was a 4-month delay between the petition being submitted in September of 2014, 10 and a half years ago, and the first hearing, which happened in January of 2015. So a 4-month delay there. And then there was a 9-month delay at the end because the last hearing at which testimony was given, contrary to what the APTIV said, was in November of 2019. And the planning board didn't act to make a recommendation until August of 2020. Now, we had COVID. 3 meetings were canceled or affected by COVID. So there was that's excusable, but the other 6 months are not excusable. So it's extraordinary in terms of the amount of time that this took, extraordinary in terms of the number of delays, the number of canceled meetings, but most extraordinary in terms of the due process violations. And the courts below, both the trial judge and the appellate division, looked at the facts and made a determination that the proceedings were fundamentally unfair because there was bias, there was predetermination, and there was collusion. And I'd like to get into that a little bit because I think it's really important, because it certainly wouldn't be fair if the proceedings themselves were fundamentally unfair to the petitioners, my clients. It certainly wouldn't be fair to send this back for a remand after 10 and a half years. And the courts said that. Both courts said that.
How do you respond to the argument that this is not intended to be an adversarial proceeding because there is no one who's allowed to represent the township? So if this was that the planning board needed to act like a judge and be completely neutral, then it should be the petitioners on one side and the township on the other so that the township can explain how they would be harmed by de-annexation. But since that is not permitted, how else is the township supposed to get in evidence about how it will be harmed by de-annexation?
Well, I think first off that the planning board has to be independent and neutral in this process. Otherwise, why do we even go there?
But
why
don't we just go to the statute council, just right? Say that no, a planning board is independent and
but
neutral.
The case law says that. The Citizens versus Strathmere case, Judge Valerie Armstrong specifically says that. She lays out that the planning board should be independent and unbiased in this situation, and that they are to make a recommendation. And they serve that role in a couple of capacities as a planning board. They don't just do it in de-annexation cases. They do it when there's going to be a review of the master plan. They do it when there's going to be a review of the zoning ordinance. So they do act in these separate functions.
But ordinary, let's say in a regular zoning case, if someone is requesting a variance.
Sorry, I missed a regular what kind of case?
In an ordinary zoning type of case, if someone is requesting a variance and then someone else opposes it, then you could see how there could be an adversarial process because there are people on both sides. I think your adversary's point is here, if there are not allowed to be people on both sides, then how could it possibly be a due process violation for the township to bring in evidence of how it would be harmed by de-annexation?
Well, I don't think it's wrong for the township to bring in evidence.
But
and they can consult with an attorney. They can consult with an attorney and put up witnesses, but it shouldn't be the retained expert by the planning board, Mr. Weiser. He was retained as an independent witness, an independent expert.
I think your adversary is arguing that they wouldn't be able to hire an attorney and bring in witnesses because then it would be, since the township makes the final decision, the argument would be, you know, you brought in you hired an attorney to oppose this, so now you're biased.
Well, I don't know.
It's supposed to work. How is the township supposed to get its evidence across?
Well, I think that the township has the resources to organize their department heads and to present testimony. But I have a real problem with the expert that's specifically retained by the planning board meeting secretly. You know, I found out about a lot of this information about these meetings that occurred later. I found out as a result of OPA requests largely, and also as a result of receiving a disc of annotated transcripts that was sent to me by the township inadvertently. So what was going on behind the scenes, you know, the hearings are, you know, they're quasi-judicial, and you have the retained expert by this quasi-judicial entity having outside the record meetings with witnesses. Now, Mr. McGuckin says there weren't witnesses, meetings, but there were meetings. If you look at the records, the billing records for Remington and Vernick, which is the engineering firm for which Mr. Weiser worked, there were numerous meetings with Mr. Ebono, who gave testimony, with other people who gave testimony in the proceedings. All these meetings happened outside the record. So they're essentially developing a record outside the record, which I think is totally inappropriate in this context.
And you say meetings between who and the experts?
Between the expert and people who testified in the hearings.
There was some comment about editorial comments being offered by Mr. Weiser in the documents that he was turning over.
And that's
another
thing.
Can you explain and give us some examples
of
that?
Sure. Mr. Weiser prepared annotated transcripts, and they're in the record. The annotated transcripts essentially had three columns, okay? And they contain transcripts of testimony that had previously been given by the, largely by the petitioners, by my clients. By the way, we didn't put on 40 witnesses. We put on 13 over 10 hearings. There may have been 40 over the whole thing, but the township had more than 20 hearings. So they had an ample opportunity. They spent twice as much time as we did putting on evidence.
Wait, sorry, can you say that one more time?
Sure. We presented our case over 10 hearings.
Okay.
The township presented their case. Township witnesses testified over 20 hearings.
So the township did present their own case. So it was an adversarial process. That's what I'm having trouble understanding.
I'm sorry. I didn't really understand. But the township witnesses, the township, the Department of Public Works testified. The chief of police testified. A lieutenant testified. Another police officer testified. There were people from all different...
And that wasn't because you called them.
I didn't call them. I did cross-examine them, but I did not call them. So the township part of the hearings lasted 20 hearings. I had about 10. There were about 20 that the township had. And then I think there were three rebuttal. And honestly, I think the other hearings didn't have full testimony. They were discussing procedure or what's going to happen next. So the main part of the hearings was the township putting on those hearings. And I want to get to the annotated transcripts because you asked a question about that. The annotated transcripts contain three columns. One column was the testimony of a particular witness. We'll take in this case, Mrs. Folkemer, who was one of my petitioners. So she testifies. The next column testifies or has sections of cross-examination that were either done by Mr. Weiser himself or by Mr. McGuckin, who conducted some very aggressive cross-examination in these hearings.
You're saying that the annotations were created by Weiser or counsel, not that the cross-examination...
No, I'm saying that the annotations, the you had three columns of the transcript. The first column is the testimony of one of my petitioners, in this case, Ms.
Then there's the annotations.
Then this, now the second section, he took out sections of cross-examination to try to meet whatever she was saying, okay, to bring out the weak points of, or the alleged weak points of what the witness said. And then a third column with his characterizations. So in the case of Mrs. Folkemer, she testified about something. I don't even remember what.
Weiser is retained by the township.
He's retained by the township or the planning board specifically to assist the planning board in this case. He was special. He doesn't work normally for, he doesn't normally do work for Berkeley Township. He was retained specifically for this case. Okay.
In the did he testify on behalf of the township?
Yes, he did. And I did
get really so strange that a testifying expert witness wouldn't go through the record and make notes as to how the testimony could be refuted.
Well, if he's doing it for himself, I don't think it's a problem. But if he's doing it specifically to give it to witnesses who are going to testify for the township, and I don't know anything about it, I think that's a problem.
But it's all very unclear because you referred to him as a neutral, that the board had to hire him as a neutral expert. But then it turns out he testified for the township. So the reason this is all very confusing is it seems that we're saying it's neutral and it's an adversarial process, but then at the same time, we're saying it's not neutral and it's totally not an adversarial process. And I'm having trouble understanding where it actually lies.
Well, on its face, he would testify that he was acting neutrally to assist the planning board.
Who called him?
Pardon me?
Who called him as a witness?
The planning board called him as a witness, basically. Yeah, the planning board called him.
You didn't call him as a witness.
I did not call him as a witness.
But the township didn't call any witnesses? That's, I think, where we're getting
township, the township presented numerous witnesses. They didn't have a lawyer do it, but they presented numerous witnesses.
So it's just that the township didn't have a lawyer.
Correct. But they presented numerous witnesses, without a doubt. They took 20 hearings to present their witnesses. So
were
they
the
present
cross-examination notations made for township witnesses that were made for South Seaside witnesses?
Yes. So
so I'm going to be clear. Yeah. So for all witnesses, regardless of whether they were called by the township or called by South Seaside, there was a preparation of where those witnesses' testimony may be cross-examinable.
I think he presented those, he presented those annotated transcripts to the township witnesses so that they could do better testimony but he also characterized my, you know, he told, for Mrs. Fulkemer, he said, politics is a hobby for her.
Let me ask the question differently. Were all of the witnesses, regardless of whether they were called by South Seaside or by Berkeley, were they all treated the same way in these annotated notes?
No.
No. Can you tell us why?
He basically, if you look at the annotations, they were designed to prop up the township's case. They were designed to prepare the witnesses who testified for the township. He didn't
know that was it on the record that these were reviewed by the witnesses before their testimony?
When I got to cross-examine these witnesses, I discovered it about halfway through after all my witnesses were on and we were in the township's case and the police were testifying. I got this disc, which inadvertently was sent to me, which had all these annotated transcripts on them. And the police, I believe it was in the middle of the police test. We were a couple of years into the hearings. And I realized what was happening. And I cross-examined the police officers as to where they got this from. And it came from Mr. Weiser. And you could read those annotations and they're in the record. They're clearly designed to prop up the township and to defeat the testimony of the petitioners, just like the email that was sent by Christopher Reed 4 months into the hearings. 4 months into the hearings, Mr. Reed, who is then the administrator of the Township of Berkeley, sends an email that is to Mr. Weiser, to members of the planning board, to members of the township, saying, we need to have a meeting so we can strategize, so we can refute the testimony of the petitioners.
So going to Justice Hoffman's question,
yes.
You have these three-column annotated documents,
yes,
that are shared with witnesses that the township is calling, but not shared with the witnesses that you are calling.
Correct. That is correct. Yeah. And designed to defeat and refute what we're saying in our case.
Can you go back to the structure of the hearing, which a number of us have asked about it already? The petitioners have you as their advocate.
Correct.
Calling witnesses and cross-examining. The planning board members are questioning all of the witnesses who testify in front of
them. They all had an opportunity. Every planning board member had an opportunity to question every witness that appeared.
And the planning board has an attorney, a quite capable one, who we just heard from.
That's correct.
What is he doing during the hearings?
He handled objections like a judge would and made rulings on relevance, which I...
Sorry, say that again?
He handled objections as if a judge would handle them. So
he decided them instead of acting like an attorney arguing them.
Correct.
Okay.
I thought you said before that he cross-examined.
He did. He also did that. He also cross-examined. If you look at the testimony of our expert, Mr. Moore, who is a very good financial expert, he testified over several meetings. Mr. McGuckin cross-examined him for pages and pages and pages.
I don't want there to be a suggestion that that was improper. So is that common at these hearings that the planning board attorney will ask questions of witnesses that appear in front?
Well, I think it is common that a planning board attorney would ask questions. I think it's uncommon that a planning board attorney would ask questions in an adversarial advocate way. And if you were in the hearings, I know it's hard to put yourself into those hearings just by reading the transcript. But if you put yourself if you were there, you would understand that the questions were very aggressive.
Stand up and say, why are you asking questions? There's something inappropriate about you asking questions.
Well, I objected many times to questions. Yes, I put my objections on the record over and over again.
Is it inappropriate in any way, based on your experience in this area, for the planning board attorney to ask questions?
I think it's inappropriate for the planning board attorney in this type of setting where you have the annexation hearing to be an advocate for the township. And
but
that's
the township
really
can't have any other
but not
advocate,
to ask
correct?
Questions. I'm sorry.
But the township can't have any other advocate, correct? So the township just can't have a lawyer, even though the petitioners can.
Well, in Citizens for Strathmere or versus Strathmere, Judge Valerie Armstrong said that the attorney cannot act in the hearing on behalf of the township.
This is the planning board attorney.
No, that the township couldn't retain a separate attorney and act in that hearing. Now,
but then,
you know,
how can it be an adversarial hearing and the planning board be neutral if one party is not allowed to hire an attorney?
Well, to me, they could have hired an attorney to prepare their witnesses. They could have done that, number one.
But not ask any questions?
Well, according to the case law. Not according to the case law.
Can you give us a citation to that case?
Citizens for Strathmere. Hold on. And I believe if you look at our the brief that we filed with the appellate division, which is in the record, there's a specific reference to it.
And no worries, we can find it.
You can give it to us after.
Yeah, I was certainly get it.
A really fundamental question about all of this, because this is a very unusual type of application that's made here. Is there something wrong or unethical or untoward with the township taking steps in the proceeding to try to block the deannexation, knowing that the planning board is unlikely to be the final word on this? This is
well, that's correct. So and the township could have had hearings itself when it went before the council or the governing body. They could
would
have
it have to
hearings.
Be both neutral and the adversary? That's what I'm not understanding. Let's say the township had held hearings, then wouldn't you argue even more that it was biased and prejudiced because they're the ones opposing the deannexation, but they're also the judicial decision maker and they have to be neutral?
No, I think the role of the planning board in this case is to try to be unbiased and neutral and just hear evidence.
So whose and then role make is a recommendation to represent the existing municipality that someone else is trying to get away from?
Well, they have a township attorney and they have lots of witnesses.
That attorney cannot participate in the process in any way in the hearings.
It's under the Strathmere case, the attorney does not participate in the hearings. That is correct.
So it can't be anyone's role to represent the municipality that someone is trying to de-annex from.
Well, I think that in the hearings before the planning board, it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be an information gathering phase.
And yet you acted, I'm sure, because we see your skill as a lawyer. You acted as an assertive adversarial lawyer in favor of the interests of your client in that setting.
Of course I did. Yes.
So. And we're hearing that your adversary here now on appeal was doing something inappropriate by asking assertive or aggressive questions, which lawyers tend to do.
Sure.
And good lawyers tend to do. And that was somehow inappropriate.
Well, that is, I only think it was inappropriate in the sense that I think Mr. McGuckin, whom I have great respect for, and actually we're friends, believe it or not.
I do believe.
Yeah. I think he crossed the line in terms of his advocacy, and maybe that's hard to see in the transcript. But I think what's really important is to understand the extent to which these proceedings lack due process and there was predetermination and there was collusion. I think that's you have to look at the big picture. And in the big picture,
just pause for a moment on the lawyer's role here, because the ultimate we don't know that every one of these is appealed. I don't know, but a number of them. Relatively few, but a number of them have been appealed to courts in which both sides are presenting a record. And if the township, which may end up being an adversary of the petitioners in an appellate court, quite likely it will, doesn't have the opportunity to use the skill and experience of its counsel to create a record that the appellate court can then review, how is that fair?
Well, I would argue that in this particular case, the planning board retained Mr. Weiser, not necessarily to.
I'm talking about Mr. Weiser. He's not your.
I know, but he did a lot of cross examination also, and they retained him to help develop a record.
But Mr. McGuckin, sorry, wasn't actually counsel for the township, right? You're alleging that he was counsel for the planning board, and so he was supposed to be neutral, and that's why it was unfair that he was acting as an adversary.
Correct.
In your view, you weren't allowed to have an adversary
correct.
At all.
He was retained specifically. He had done two other cases, Seaview Harbor and I think Avalon Manor, and he was retained specifically to make recommendations to the planning board and to hear the testimony and to prepare a report, which he did, a 399-page report.
If you weren't allowed to have
report.
An adversary, how could it possibly be a neutral proceeding?
Can I ask
There's
a question?
Only an attorney on one side.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
Based on something you said earlier, is it typically that you as an advocate would represent the interests of your client making a claim to the planning board, who is then supposed to gather the information, make a recommendation to someone else, right? To the
That's township? In this particular case, yes, they're making a recommendation to the governing body, who then has the right, if they want to hold hearings.
In previous cases where you've done that, if that's the case, what does the planning board attorney normally do?
Well, this, you know, there's only a handful of de-annexation cases in the state of New Jersey. So while I've been intimately involved for the last 10 years in this one, I haven't been involved in any others.
But other cases with regard to, I mean, matters are brought to the planning board all the time.
Absolutely. So if there's a zoning issue, a variance, or a planning board would typically hear a subdivision or a site plan. So what would typically happen in that case is the board is supposed to hear the evidence and act independently. If there is opposition to the application, there are people that normally would come forward and speak in opposition.
And those people can have counsel, correct?
Once in a while, somebody hires an attorney.
But they're allowed to.
Oh, certainly, but it's rare. I would say it's relatively rare. I would say most people do not, unless it's a big application for a big shopping center, or, you know, it's Wawa fighting Quick Check or something like that.
Is that a situation?
You see counsel in those cases a lot.
Is that a situation where the planning board might have their own engineer or an expert that they bring in to sort of give testimony about the circumstances?
Sure. The planning board always has its own engineer, and they always have its own planner, typically. And Berkeley does have its own engineer and its own planner. They hired or brought in Mr. Weiser, specially in addition to those people, in addition to their regular planner, in addition to their regular engineer.
Why couldn't they do that?
Pardon me?
Why couldn't they do that?
I'm not saying that they couldn't.
But you're here before us saying that there was something, the process was fundamentally flawed. And the two of them, and there have been other arguments, but two of the arguments we've heard is, one, the lawyer acted too much as an advocate for a client and questioned in a way that you thought was but it was too much of a normal lawyer cross-examination process. And the second thing is this, the presence of Weiser, who you're talking about is analyzing the testimony and so forth in the background.
I have no problem with Weiser being serving the board. That's not the issue for me. The issue is not that Mr. Weiser served the board. The issue was that Mr. Weiser was on an email chain that Justice Hoffman referenced, indicating 4 months into the hearings, before we had even, you know, gotten through our regular witnesses, that he's on an email chain with other professionals, the regular planner, the regular engineer for the board, with certain board members, with members of the council, and they're strategizing to have a meeting to refute the testimony of petitioners before we even have presented our case. I don't know if that shows prejudgment. It certainly does to me. It shows that they've predetermined things. If they're having meetings 4 months in, and I didn't discover this email until 2 or 3 years after we were into the hearings, because I was making OPA requests. And in one of my OPA requests, I received a banker box of emails, and about 3/4 of the way down, I found this email. So they were having meetings. There was stuff going on behind the scenes before we'd even put our testimony in.
And did he ultimately testify?
Mr. Weiser did ultimately testify, but by the time he testified, and I did get the cross-examination.
My question is this, he testified. I mean, he's functioning as, in essence, an expert, right?
Correct.
And he's giving an opinion on whether or not the statutory standard is met here.
Right.
Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
What was wrong with him strategizing about how to refute the arguments of your client and your client's experts?
Well, I think it's wrong for him to strategize when the people that he's strategizing with, that email was sent to people on the council. And basically, the township council, the governing body. That email was sent to, I believe, Mr. McGuckin was probably on that email. Various witnesses that were testifying.
And that's because the town council has to be both neutral and adverse to your clients. That's what I'm fundamentally not understanding. If the municipality that gets this petition does not want the petitioners to leave, how are they supposed to make that known? Are they not allowed to be adverse?
No, I think the township itself can be adverse. I think the governing body, they get the recommendation.
Township employees were on the email. So if the township can be adverse, wouldn't they be adverse through their employees?
They would be adverse through their employees. But what I find is the process is tainted. The process is tainted when before we're even in a position, if Mr. Weiser is there to serve the board and to give an unbiased report and recommendation, how can he possibly be unbiased? And he admitted that it appeared that he was not unbiased. He admitted that freely, that he appeared that he was not being unbiased when I presented him with the email.
Is it your point that he was wearing two hats? One would have been fine. Either hat would have been fine. Both is the problem. Prepping witnesses with editorial comments and serving as an aide in that regard would be okay, but then you can't present yourself as a neutral expert coming from.
Yeah, he presented as a neutral, courts appoint experts, right? So occasionally a trial court will appoint an expert in some kind of a matter. This is very much like a court appointed expert, somebody who's going to be appointed to govern, to help the board make a decision, right?
So I guess where did the planning board or he say that he was neutral? Where in the record did they purport that
he acknowledged in cross-examination that I made of him that he was supposed to provide an unbiased, neutral recommendation to the planning board. He acknowledged that was his role. Okay. So he specifically acknowledged that.
Is there any impediment to the township having counsel who's not there for the planning board, but there for the township trying to oppose your client's application, having a lawyer cross-examine your witnesses, your clients, and having an expert witness appear and present the township's position against the annexation?
They could have chosen to do that. I'm not sure it would have been consistent with Strathmere, but they could have chosen to do that.
Did you ever take the position that they should not have an independent lawyer?
I never said that. Not in the record.
Absolutely. Didn't Mr. I'm sorry. I know there's a lot of discussion about what could have happened, whether a lawyer could have been appointed, but what did happen was Mr. McGuckin did cross-examine witnesses.
Correct. And so did Mr. Weiser.
Did happen. And there was witnesses presented by the planning board. And so this wasn't scenario where the township or the planning board, whether they're one and the same, didn't present any witnesses, didn't have any cross-examination, didn't have any means of bringing forth any of their information to oppose, to present their position with regard to the de-annexation. It seems like that happened here.
Yes, there were.
And maybe there wasn't a specific outside attorney, but it seems like their position was presented. So I'm not.
There was days of cross-examination by both sides.
Honestly. That seems like the basis of your argument that it was biased. Like your whole argument that it was biased is that they, instead of hiring an outside attorney and an outside expert that would be representing the township, which was prohibited under Strathmere, as you explained, they did so under an attorney for the planning board and an expert for the planning board, who you are arguing were required to be neutral, and therefore the whole process was tainted because these people who were supposed to be neutral were not acting as neutrals. But then it seems like you're also admitting that they could not have acted on behalf of the township. So that's how we end up in this.
Well, I understand what you're saying. And I don't know whether or not the township could have had an attorney there or not. What I do know is there was plenty of process. I mean, the township had 20 meetings. Mr. Weiser asked.
Saying they had process, but a big complaint you have is that they had cross-examination and they had an expert who was acting as the expert for one side and not the other.
I don't object to the fact that they asked questions or that they had cross-examination. That is not my objection. My only objection to Mr. McGuckin is the manner in which he conducted the cross-examination. It was very aggressive, and I thought that went over the line in terms of how a planning board would typically act in this situation. What I find objectionable about Mr. Weiser is that he was prepping the township witnesses, that he was having these meetings outside, that he admitted that it didn't appear that he was acting in an unbiased and neutral fashion, which he admitted that the case law required him to act upon. In his report, he has a 399-page report. The pages and they're actually in Mr. McGuckin's submission, DA 17 to DA 56. He has 37 pages where he discusses every single case that has ever happened in the state of New Jersey with regard to de-annexation. So he summarizes the law, and then he has an analysis section where he applies that law to South Seaside Park. And what he did with
there are environmental experts, for example.
I don't have an objection to him doing that. The objection is this. In 1978, Judge Addison, and the opinions that he went through were published and unpublished, because there just aren't that many de-annexation cases. But what he did was he prepared this report, and in those 37 pages, when he analyzed all the law, all of it, unpublished and published, he left out the case that Judge Addison wrote involving this very same area of land in 1978. He left it out. When I asked him why, you know, you included all these decisions and you left out the case that I would think would be most relevant because it's the same distance of 16.2 miles. It's the same barrier peninsula. There's a lot of the same issues in terms of the beach. He said, well, Mr. McGuckin never gave me that case. That was his answer to that. So here he purports to analyze the law and direct the, you know, make a recommendation to the planning board that's going to be used by the governing body. And he leaves out the seminal, what I would say is the seminal case, because it's the same exact case. In fact, the plaintiff in that case was Don Whiteman Sr. I represent Don Whiteman Jr. That case didn't, de-annexation didn't happen, even though the court ordered it, because Seaside Park.
I think are we getting a little off?
They elected not to take them. Well, no, I think it shows two things. I think it shows part of the bias. And the other thing that he did in that 37 pages where he analyzes the law and applies all the cases is he took out the word Seaview Harbor and he put in the word South Seaside Park and he took out the word Egg Harbor Township and he put in Berkeley Township. So 37 pages was virtually identical to a report that he'd done before. He did no new analysis and he just substituted the names of the
parks. And that happens.
And it does happen.
Experts will try to cut and paste, and experts are exposed in doing that on cross-examination, and it affects their credibility. But you're saying that the whole process was fundamentally.
Well, when you have an expert who's specifically there to guide the board, and he meets with witnesses, and he acknowledges his position is supposed to be unbiased, and acknowledges that he has the appearance of bias, and then he drops out and doesn't include the same case, which was very important. I find that under those circumstances that there's a lack of due process. And Mr. Bacchione, who served on the council, on the governing body, he was the man who served on the governing body. He went to Holiday City to the Italian American Club before the hearing started. And he said, you better show up at these hearings because your taxes are going to go up. Now, what's interesting about that is—
Come back to Mr. Weiser for a second. From what you learned during cross-examination and the course of the proceedings, he prepared this document, this three-column document that was shown to witnesses. Did he sit with the witnesses and help prep them?
I believe
as well?
He sat with some of the witnesses, not all of the witnesses. I know if you look at the time records for the Remington and Vernick firm, of which he was a part, there were various meetings with many of those witnesses. And I believe Mr. Ebineau said that he had sat with him. I don't know the extent, honestly, to which he went through the transcripts, but I do know for a fact that he met with some of the witnesses and, you know, the extent of those conversations, I don't know because the time entries indicated that he would simply be meeting with them. And they, when I asked questions about him or the witness, they, well, we discussed general issues about de-annexation. You know, that I got kind of, broad responses, but I believe that he certainly coached them under those circumstances, and the courts found that.
You can go back to the other point. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So Mr. Bacchione, the council member who was sitting on the board at the time, on the planning board, he met with these property owners ahead of time at the Italian American Club in Holiday City, which is a very large community of 8,000 senior homes, 55 and up. The average home back then was worth $128,000. So it's not a high-end community. And the most of these people would be subject to a tax freeze, because I think even back then, the household income for a tax freeze was $87,000. So if you made less than $87,000, your taxes were frozen. They weren't going to go up under any circumstances. So he went to those people and he said, you better show up at these meetings because your taxes are going to go up. So to me, that shows, number one, he's already prejudged the matter. It may be true that taxes were going to go up, but he'd already prejudged the matter. Number two, he was inciting fear in them. Number three, what he told them was probably not true. And Elaine Vitarella, one of our clients, testified that she felt fearful as a result of his comments. And it wasn't true because of the tax freeze. Mr. Callahan, one of the board members, had a sign. We had signs, South Seaside Park Homeowners and Voter Association sign. At PA 257, you'll see the sign. The sign is on the border of Mr. Callahan's property. Right behind it is his car and his house. He claimed it wasn't his sign. It must have belonged to the neighbor, but it was directly on the property line. You see his house and his car right behind it in the way that the sign is situated. He left it up there for years during the hearings, and it had a big red circle on it and an X through it, you know, against us, essentially showing that he did not support us. And the board wouldn't allow me to ask him questions about that. And then there were comments by the township administrator who said it was elitist. In the very first meeting, before the planning board, I tried to bring up Judge Addison's decision from 1978, and the board opposed me. They said, well, that's a long time ago. And I said, it is a long time ago, but it will at least be instructive because we're dealing with the same type of distance. We're dealing with some of the same issues. You're going to lose the 1,000 feet of beach. And Judge Addison had said there are three public beaches that are closer. So I tried to bring that up. The board actually took a vote and denied me the opportunity to bring up Judge Addison's decision. I tried to bring it up 2.5 years later. So this is at PA 575 to 579. And then 2.5 years later at PA 971, I tried to bring it up again. And the board, Mr. McGuckin, said, we already ruled. That's totally irrelevant. You can't bring that up. Well, I find that to be prejudicial. I find that to be evidence of bias. So yes, I think, and then I tried to bring in other information. I tried to bring in somebody who had been on the Board of Education for 4 years, Mr. Fulkemer, to testify about the possibility of them getting state aid in the event, more state aid in the event that this small area was de-annexed. They wouldn't allow him to testify as an expert.
Can you speak to the school tax issue?
Yes, I can. So with the school tax issue, first of all, I would say it was not an issue for the township, because if you look at the resolution at page 15, it specifically doesn't say anything about the school tax. So the resolution at page that the governing body adopted at page 15 of that resolution, which it looks like it's DA 478. It specifically says annual tax increases of $19 for a home assessed at $100,000, $35 for an average home assessed at $183,600. So it's talking about the tax impact. The only thing it says about school taxes on the page before, when it says the municipality and its local school district are subject to a 2% cap. It doesn't say anything about school taxes in the resolution. So it wasn't an issue that the governing body was relying upon in denying de-annexation here. So I think that that's just something that isn't relevant in that sense.
You dispute the loss of school tax?
I don't dispute that there will be a loss. What you have to keep in context, though, is that we tried to get our expert, Ken Moore, tried to get school aid information. First of all, he testified that there would be more federal aid available under the formula because, which is then administered through the states. He testified to that specifically, I believe at 971, PA 971. But he tried to get information available as to how much aid would be available. When you take out these tax assessments, how much additional governmental aid would be available. And he said he was not able to get that information because he was not part of the town. But the town could get that information, but the town never asked for it. I asked the town to ask for it, but they never asked for the amount of school aid. That's number one. Number one is
really... And they never asked the the education department, New Jersey Education Department.
Correct. They never
how
asked.
Much more will we get? Does that does the New Jersey Education Department, Department of Education, give that information out prospectively? Which
well,
is
I'm sure that my adversary will say otherwise, but there was a letter that we had that we marked in evidence, which involved a different part of Berkeley Township from a couple of years before. There was a time when Holiday City was thinking that they wanted the annex because there were all these senior communities and they wanted to be their own community. They felt that they weren't getting hurt. So there was a letter written to the legislators, the local legislators, who signed a letter back to Mr. Fulcomer, our client, specifically indicating that if Holiday City de-annexed, that there would be additional state aid available. So we thought, based on that letter and based on the research that our expert did, our expert said that you would be able to get that information. And our expert was a very qualified municipal accountant. He said you would be able to get that information from the Department of Education if it was asked for. The town never asked.
Sorry, so we're on the prong where it says the annexation will not cause a significant injury to the well-being of the municipality in which the land is located, right? That's under 7-12.1.
Right.
So their argument is it will cause a significant injury because there's this $121 tax increase per additional per every person who lives in the municipality. What is your response to that? It's that
well,
you weren't permitted to enter evidence that it wouldn't be a significant injury?
Number one, no, I don't think it'll be a significant injury. For number one, it was for the average taxpayer, meaning the average household assessed at that time of $183,000. If we're most of the resolution is in terms of how much per 100,000. So per 100,000, that would be about $60, okay, per 100,000 of
regardless, your adversary points out that they think that they're losing 10.6% of all of their property tax base when it comes to the school district. Do you deny that?
I don't deny that they're losing the assessments. I deny that they're losing 10.6% of their money because you have to look at cost savings. Now, maybe with the
what
school,
are the cost savings related to the school? Your point is not.
Yeah, well, they would have minimal cost. They would have some cost savings because they won't have to send a bus 45 minutes. The testimony was.
Is that in the record what the bus cost is? I'm just asking.
The bus cost is not in the record, but there would be some additional cost. Now, understand, Central Regional School District takes care of 7 through 12. So whether you live in Berkeley Township or whether you live in Seaside Park, if there's de-annexation, those numbers don't change.
Just focusing only on prong three and the fact that you have to prove all three prongs. What is your evidence that it would not cause a significant injury to the well-being of the municipality in which the land is located by losing 10.6% of their tax base?
Well, you have to look at net numbers, not gross numbers. And as Judge Ford found below, when you factor in the cost savings, it's not a 10.66% or 6-8% loss.
I thought you said you didn't put in any cost savings because there are no cost savings related. Correct. That's the only thing we're talking about.
We're just talking about school. Okay, I understand. With regard to the school, okay, I think it's a misnomer to say it's $121 for every taxpayer. It's $121 for the average assessed house at $183,600. At $100 per assessment or $100,000 per assessment, it's about $64 or $65, something like that.
Your clients are among, as I understand this record, to be among the more affluent people in the town.
Absolutely not. We are one of five neighborhoods that have a decent, a higher than the town. What you have generally in terms of assessments, but it's not higher than Pelican Island. It's similar to Berkeley Shores, Glencoe.
I used the wrong line. All I'm saying is you have some of the more valuable properties that would be leaving. So if it's 63 per 100,000 assessed value, and you have some houses that are worth, I don't know what they're worth, but they're worth over
100,000. If you've been down there, it's a real mix of housing. You have two mobile home communities. Okay. You have some condominiums and you have single family homes. So it's not like Seaview Harbor. Seaview Harbor was the only waterfront community in Egg Harbor Township, the only one, and it was the most affluent one.
I asked a question that got us on a tangent. So all I'm saying is that that if there are some that are above the average, then that is going to be a significant bite into their tax base.
But it also provides, on the other end, it gives them an opportunity to get more state aid. And that's what we were prevented from getting. Where our state or federal actually comes from the federal government into the state. And we were prevented from getting that, and they could have had the opportunity to get that. And it wasn't relied upon in the resolution. The resolution doesn't talk anything about school tax. So, you know, it wasn't an issue for the town. And their own expert and our own expert both said that the town would fully recover in less than 5 years, fully recover, that this would be essentially a temporary bump. Their experts said that.
Do you contest that there would be, they would lose tax revenues?
Of course. In every de-annexation case, there's going to be a certain amount of tax loss. Every single one. But the issue is it significant here?
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think your argument is.
And I don't think it's significant here.
But no court has ever found 10.6% of property lost to be not significant, correct?
Well, I don't think that the issue is whether or not you lose 10.6% of your assessments. I think the issue is, what is the actual cost to the taxpayer? What is the net to the taxpayer as a result of that? And our expert said, if you get rid of two police cars, you have absolutely no municipal tax. You have no local purpose tax at all. And if you keep them, it's still not very much. There is going to be some increase in the school tax. But again, that wasn't relied upon in the resolution. That wasn't an issue.
I don't understand mathematically that offset. For the offset with regard to the municipal tax, how much goes down when the school tax goes up? How much goes down per person when the school tax goes up?
Well, the municipal tax would be totally eliminated if they got rid of three.
How much would be totally eliminated?
Is
it $19?
Certainly the $19.
If 19 is eliminated and 120 somewhat is added,
It's not 120 because that 19 is based on $100,000 of assessment. So if you take the, it would be like 64.
$65 is added.
About $64 or $65, correct.
So then you're talking about a 40 some odd dollar impact for only a 5 year time.
Correct. And that their expert acknowledged he had worked specifically in distressed towns like Camden and Patterson. And he specifically said, yes, we're going to be able to recover in a relatively short amount of time. We do some cost savings. We do some things here that we can do from a financial standpoint, and it's not going to be a major impact. And our experts certainly said that as well. And like I said, I don't think that they get to reward it for not asking for the aid information. I think that they should have at least asked. If they couldn't get it, show us a letter saying that you can't get it. But our expert said there was federal aid that would be available that would even reduce that number further, but he wasn't able to get that information.
And so we're well into the afternoon at this point.
Sorry. Is there
anything you'd like to add? I'm not asking you to apologize.
Well, I thought maybe I'd talk a little bit about IA and, oh, no, just kidding. Thank you very much.
Ms. McGuckin, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I ask you something first?
Sure.
I heard you say earlier, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that had you gotten an attorney, had the town gotten an attorney, there could have been or would have been an accusation that there was bias. Not that you couldn't get an attorney.
Well,
was
we
that
were correct? We were certainly aware of the Strathmere case, which says you can't. And that was an unpublished trial court decision, and the appellate division affirmed the trial court in an unreported decision. But we were certainly aware that the trial court in that case said that you can't have a township attorney in an adversarial position. But had we done so in this case, and we certainly discussed in one of those meetings that Mr. McElhinney says is so improper, one of those meetings was, can the township present an attorney? Well, Strathmere said you can't. So now what do we do? How are we going to present any evidence in opposition? So we did what they did in Seaview Harbor. We did what they did in Avalon Manor. That is, had a planner come in and testify and provide evidence and obtain witnesses to speak on behalf of the municipality with respect to those issues.
In those cases, did the expert help prepare other witnesses?
I can't say for certain. I would imagine they did. I don't see any reason they wouldn't have. But I think it's important to recognize that I guarantee you that Mr. Michelini prepped every one of his witnesses before they testified in that hearing. I can guarantee.
But he didn't testify. So
he didn't
testify.
Is that a fair
analogy?
Is true. That is true. I don't think it's
analogy?
A difference because, as I believe Justice indicated, any expert would want to know what witnesses are going to say, what they're going to infer, what the other witnesses testified to, so that they can render their opinion in the end. I don't think that's inappropriate at all. I really don't.
So your analogy works if these were, quote unquote, Mr. Weiser's witnesses. Would they appropriately be considered Mr. Weiser's witnesses? As you just mentioned, Mr. Michelini's witnesses. So on the other hand, then, are these Mr. Weiser's witnesses?
They were the board's witnesses, the township's witnesses, Mr. Weiser's witnesses. They were all, because there's no one else to advocate on behalf of the other citizens of Berkeley Township. There's no one else to advocate or present witnesses on behalf of the township's position on these issues. And if the township takes a position, that argument would be here today, that the township actually went and hired a lawyer to defeat our application. That's obviously bias, prejudice, and prejudgment.
Not necessarily. It just is an argument.
It's an argument. No, thank you.
But you were there cross-examining witnesses.
Well, you know, counsel says I cross-examine witnesses. I do many planning boards, and there are times when the board attorney will ask questions. And I can also indicate that none of my questions were any more difficult than those raised by Mr. Michelini with respect to any other witness that he cross-examined.
So you wouldn't characterize your question. So you're saying you questioned witnesses, but you did not cross-examine witnesses.
No, I don't think there's much of a difference there. Certainly, you cross-examined the veracity of some of their statements. You questioned their truthfulness in some of the testimony they gave, like when they said it took 25 minutes for a police officer to arrive, and in fact, it was seven.
But I think his point was he was an adversary, but you weren't allowed to be an adversary. You had to be a neutral. And so that's why you're not allowed to do the same thing he's doing, because he is not a neutral and you are.
That's correct. And it's the same on a planning board application. If I'm representing the board and I think the board should hear a particular fact to make their decision, I may interject and intervene and ask a question of a witness of an applicant who's represented by counsel on behalf of the board so they can make an appropriate decision. And I don't think that's certainly not inappropriate. And under these facts, it's necessary because no one else is there who can do that.
So is it a fair characterization that there was no way that the township did not have the opportunity to present any information or any witnesses or their position on the deannexation? Because that's how you presented your argument when you were before us a little over an hour ago. Is that a fair characterization? The township couldn't bring any witnesses. The township couldn't present their position. It doesn't sound like that's what happened.
Well, they couldn't do it through an attorney. I didn't prep any witnesses. I didn't sit with any witnesses ahead of time. And I'm an attorney for the board.
Is it that they couldn't or they didn't?
I'm sorry.
Is it that they couldn't have done it through an attorney or that they decided not to do it through an attorney?
Well, Strathmere tells us you couldn't do it.
An unpublished, non-precedential opinion that has gotten a lot of attention, which we don't rely on. And is so my question is, could you have?
I think in hindsight, and assuming this court were to reverse the matter, I think that'd be an appropriate instruction to allow the township to make it an adversarial proceeding and to present testimony, present witnesses to avoid this other question that's come up about due process.
Were the town's hands tied behind its back?
I believe, yes.
They had somebody who was quite capable at making arguments and presenting positions, and they had 20 witnesses.
Well, it was tied behind their back in that every time I ask a question, as you heard, I'm being an adversary.
On behalf of the town? I thought you were the board's attorney and not the town's attorney, and so you could not argue on behalf of the town.
That's correct. I can't argue on behalf of the town. I can only argue on behalf of the board.
This proceeding, there was only one adversary. There were petitioners. There was no attorney on the other side.
That's correct.
I misspoke. I was referring to the board. I thought you understood that. Were the planning board's hands tied behind its back with 20 witnesses being presented, with prep sessions, with a capable attorney interposing questions that you said could be considered cross-examination, could be considered questioning in your judgment? Was the board's hand tied?
I think the board could ask questions. I think the board could have witnesses presented, and in fact, they did. And that a lot of that testimony refuted that of the petitioners. So I don't think it was our hands were tied in any respect. I think the problem was, if the board went too far to try to obtain that information, the argument is bias and prejudice.
Correct. And the board was supposed to be neutral. And so the real argument is, could the township present evidence on the other side? And your answer to that was no, because the township couldn't hire a lawyer or put on its own case.
And the same argument would be raised before this court that's raised here, bias and prejudice.
Did you prep witnesses that appeared before the planning board at all?
No, sir. And I did attend two meetings at the beginning of the process where the township said, how do we handle these things? What do we do here? And Mr. Weiser was in a meeting, and I believe the mayor was in a meeting, and we said, township's going to have to find a way to present witnesses. We can't do it. The township attorney shouldn't do it. That's what we told him. And that's what Mr. Weiser, that's some of the meetings that Mr. Weiser attended.
So is Mr. Weiser in that sense sort of stepping into your shoes in preparing witnesses for testimony or for cross-examination?
I wouldn't say it was preparing witnesses. I do believe that he presented them with the documentation that was going to address their field.
That's preparation, right?
I don't think he sat with witnesses and he was cross-examined repeatedly, as was every witness. No one said Mr. Weiser told us what to say.
Giving a witness what to be aware of during potential cross. Are we talking a different language? I mean, isn't that preparation?
I understand. That could be considered prepping a witness, but he certainly didn't coach them and tell them that they must testify to this because you have to refute that.
And he did that, sorry, because there was no attorney who
That's correct.
Could do that.
That's correct.
But so on his own, Mr. Weiser sat with the witnesses that were called by the planning board and chose to discuss whatever they discussed, right, without the benefit of an attorney or anybody from the planning board involved in those discussions?
My understanding is that's correct. I certainly wasn't involved in them. And I don't believe he met with them. I believe he forwarded almost every one of them. He forwarded the transcripts of testimony in their relevant field.
So it was communication about the testimony and about the potential testimony of those individual witnesses.
That's correct. Mr. Weiser did that. And
am I missing something? He's not a lawyer.
No, he's not. He's a planner.
And so he's giving them more. This is what's been said about this particular specific planning type issue or whatever it might be.
Yep.
He's not trying to shape their direct examination or.
That's absolutely correct. And every single witness was asked, did Mr. Weiser try to shape your testimony? Did Mr. Weiser tell you what to say? The answer to that under oath was every single time, no.
Did you stipulate that the unpublished trial decision affirmed by an unpublished appellate division decision controlled?
No. I submit that Seaview Harbor, although it doesn't control this court, Seaview Harbor and Avalon Manor control the trial court. And respectfully, the appellate division, my opinion, did not quite follow those. And respectfully, this case would be not analogous to either one of those and would really be sitting out there if it's allowed to be affirmed.
But you did make a decision to follow Strathmere.
Well, I was imagining you would say the path of least resistance. We're not going to pick a fight over having an attorney from the township hired or the township attorney itself when we know a judge has already ruled that that's not appropriate and the appellate division chose not to overturn that decision.
And when you said in Avalon Township and the other case, Seaview Harbor, those went with the Strathmere rule, that the township does not have an attorney.
That's correct.
To represent it, and the township does not have.
Okay. That's correct.
This question about whether the township can or cannot have an attorney, we have a three-prong test. One of the findings, the first prong, was that there was bias and collusion and predetermination and so on. This issue, is it central to the case? I know we spent a lot of time on it.
I don't believe it is. Quite frankly, as I said earlier.
Not the issue about the attorney or lack of an attorney.
Well, I think it's important because the other arguments of petitioners that there was bias and because Mr. Weiser met with witnesses or talked to witnesses or sent them testimony. In that context, it is important. But with respect to the overall issue in this case, did the plaintiff meet their burden? Were they prevented from meeting their burden by the board? And counsel talks about school funding. Well, listen, I would love the Department of Education to tell me what my towns will be receiving over the next 5 years in school funding. You don't know that till the day they issue it. That is so speculative and unreasonable. And to argue that somehow that should impact the board's decision or the township's decision in this case on school tax increase, respectfully, is of no bearing whatsoever. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. School funding changes every single year, particularly in Berkeley Township.
Can you respond to the argument that this is not in the resolution and was not relied upon?
Certainly, as we did before the tribal court, and it's all in the record, the resolution of the board specifically referred to Mr. Weiser's 399-page report and incorporated it by reference, the entire thing. And Mr. Weiser's report specifically refers to Mr. Moore's report, the plaintiff's own expert. Mr. Weiser points out the school tax increase in his report. The issue in the resolution related to the municipal tax revenue. And that was hotly contested through months of these proceedings.
So I'm looking at page 15 of the report, DA 478, which speaks about the $19 Is there a place in the resolution that speaks to the loss of school taxes that the township relied on?
Yes, I believe it's Defendant's Appendix 357 and 398, which refers to the Moore Report.
I'm talking about the resolution.
Oh, I'm sorry. The resolution does not, but it refers to Mr. Weiser's report and incorporates it.
Thank you.
I think I'd like to conclude with the following. As I said in the beginning, due process is not something that's irrelevant. It's important. But was there sufficient due process granted to these petitioners? We submit it certainly was. I don't believe there was a prejudgment or a bias simply because the questions were asked or a governing body member told residents a factual statement. But I would submit that nothing prevented the petitioners from meeting their burden of proof from the board or the township. And I would also submit that the ultimate decision maker in this case was the township council. They are the ones who make the decision. And when there's face a $121 tax increase for every remaining resident of Berkeley Township in 2014 numbers, for them to determine that that was substantial, it certainly not be considered arbitrary or unreasonable. And that's the crux of this case, in my opinion.
I'm sorry to ask one more question, but you're quoting different numbers, $64, $121. What is the apples to apples comparison?
I am using the plaintiff's expert's report that said there would be a $121 tax increase for the Berkeley Township School District for the remaining residents of Berkeley Township. That's the one I'm using. Where Mr. McLean got the 65, I'm really not sure.
And I think your adversary is arguing that that was an average based on property value of $183,000 or so, so that if the property value is $100,000, that would be much lower.
Well, there, even in 2014, very few properties in Berkeley Township.
I'm not talking about that. Do you agree that those numbers were based on the average with regard to the property value? So the $121 is with regard to the average of 183. So therefore, by math, simple math, any property values lower than that would be lower than 121.
Correct. And anything higher would be much higher.
Okay.
Correct.
So we're talking about, both of you are talking about the same numbers. Just, correct. Okay.
And the average is based on Berkeley Township. It wasn't just made up, right?
That's correct. It was based on Berkeley Township's remaining residents, taxpayers of Berkeley Township.
And that municipal township potential offset is based on $100,000 too. $19 for every $100,000, right?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understood that argument because the experts testified that there'd be a wash, that there would not be an increase in the municipal tax rate as a result of de-annexation. Wouldn't be a decrease. Well, I shouldn't say that. Petitioners tried to argue contrary, but there wouldn't be an increase. It would still be the same tax rate, municipal tax rate, if de-annexation occurs and you get rid of police and you get rid of police cars and you ameliorate that in some other way.
So if you got rid of all of those things, you'd still be paying the same amount of municipal tax?
Paying the same amount of municipal taxes as they are before de-annexation.
The $19 is for a home assessed at $100,000.
Correct.
That would correspond to the $64 number if we were going to use the same metric.
Okay. I would believe that would be correct. And I think that's part of the problem in this case, all the various numbers that have gone back and forth. Respectfully, we believe it's undisputed that the loss of 10.6% of a township's tax base cannot be considered anything less than substantial. We believe the loss of an increase in municipal taxes for schools of $121 cannot be considered insubstantial, particularly since those are 2014 numbers.
And did you also concede that that number would go away after 5 years?
No, thank you. No, we don't concede that at all. And the only way it could be decreased is if additional ratables are added to the municipality. That's what he's talking about.
That was about vacant land, right?
There's some land left. The township has the ability to have more ratables on the mainland in the future. As Avalon Manor instructs, that's not a proper factor to be considered.
The appellate division actually took that out of the trial courts.
That's correct, because it's not appropriate. Well,
because it has nothing to do with de-annexation. That could happen regardless of whether
that's correct. Those future ratables already belong to the municipality. So no, I respectfully don't agree that that's the case. And I would submit that even though the appellate division found that the trial court was incorrect, nevertheless, they allowed the decision to stand. I think that's it. Unless there's any further questions, I know you have another case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Take the matter under advisement.